And one of the things that's probably the most important is that when we talk about the autism spectrum, the spectrum reflects a wide range of differences. It's not a line. It's not from very autistic at one end and not very autistic at the other end. We all have unique combinations of challenges and strengths. And one of the things that's really important to note here is that we're very much talking about a developmental condition, not a disease that can be cured or should be cured or changed. And that's very important to our perspective as autistic people. So on the next slide. Is it? Okay. So what is autism? We're all individuals. As I said, we all have unique strengths and challenges. There are some common features. So typically autistic people tend to have difficulties with communication and social interaction, things like understanding social and communication cues, using language to express needs. We often have restrictive and repetitive behaviours, things like intense interest in specific topics, needing to stick to routines, liking things to be the same. Many of us have sensory sensitivities. So we may be extremely sensitive to light, noise, smell, touch, other sensory issues. It is important, though, always to remember that, you know, as Stephen Shaw famously said, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. We are all different. We all have, you know, our own aspects to ourselves, but these are just sort of some common challenges. So on my last slide, I was asked to just briefly touch on the issue of language. So, Felicity. Hopefully we're going to go to language. All right. Well, there will be a slide in a moment, but basically we want people to feel open to use whatever terminology you want to. And we have been very clear that, you know, we're not going to be critical of people if they use terms that aren't the ones we would prefer. But we are very much of the view that identity first language is the preference. We don't see our autism as an accessory that we pick up and put down at various times. It's very fundamental to who we are as individuals. We also don't think that it's something negative that we want to have disconnected from ourselves. So we will typically tend to use identity first language. We're going to encourage you to make that transition if you're not already. But please feel free to use whatever language you're comfortable with when asking questions, and don't feel inhibited. The other thing that's just worth mentioning there is we do tend to avoid the use of functioning labels. They are very unpopular in the community. To call someone high functioning really isn't a compliment. Basically, what it means is my autism doesn't bother you, not that it isn't causing challenges for me. And it does underestimate the challenges that we experience, and calling someone low functioning is deeply offensive as well, and ignores and underestimates that people do have unique strengths and challenges that may not be immediately visible. So those are just two language things I wanted to touch on. And then if we stop sharing the screen, I will ask our panelists to introduce themselves. Shadia.
Hi, everyone. My name is Shadia. Some of you know me already. It's nice to see some familiar faces. I am a speech pathology student at ACU, and I was formally identified as autistic at around the age of 3. So I'm one of the lucky ones that was picked up quite early. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to sharing my experiences with you all today.
Thank you. Kylie.
My name's Kylie McLeish. I am an ACU alumni. I work at Bayside City Council. I was formally diagnosed at the age of 32 when doing my Master's of Commerce.
Thank you. Sarah?
Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah. I am a graduate of ACU, and I also currently work at ACU as a personal assistant and project officer in the Faculty of Education and Arts. And I was diagnosed this year, so very recent, very new.
And Jennifer?
Hi everyone, I'm Jennifer Lowe. I am a PhD student at La Trobe, and I was diagnosed with autism at the age of 30 in 2018, so 3 years ago.
Thank you. So it was actually good that we had a number of questions about diagnosis, because you'll see that on our panel represents quite a wide variety. Just a reminder with the questions, I'm going to go through the ones that were given to me in advance. If you've got questions, please put them in the chat. Bree's monitoring the chat and she will jump in and add any questions that come through from people. So as I say, I'll try and keep this segment to not more than 15 minutes, so we've got plenty of time for the next part. So the first question, what prompted you to have go and get your autism diagnosis? How did you, what made you suspect that you were on the spectrum? Kylie.
I was on my way to a class one day during my master's, and I had to stop at my psychiatrist. And he asked me if anyone had ever suggested that I might be autistic. So we went through, I looked at it all, and it all started to kind of make sense. So after a lot of phone calls, I found someone who was willing to work with me on whether or not I was going to get a diagnosis.
Great, thank you. Jennifer.
So for me, I actually didn't go looking for an autism diagnosis as such. I, at the time, was a PhD student. I was teaching casually at uni, and I was also working in a research assistant role. And I found it really difficult to switch between tasks. So on days that I was teaching, I found it really difficult to focus on my PhD. And, you know, I'd sort of get halfway through the day and really have trouble with that. So I sought out an educational psychologist, thinking that they were going to give me the secret to life in terms of strategies that would just sort of, you know, help me be like everybody else. And then, yeah, she said, you know, I think you might be on the spectrum. And everything made sense from there. And it was a sense of massive relief, and also quite a bit of grief as well afterwards, working through, you know, what would my life have been like, and sort of coming to terms with that. So that's how it came about for me.
Thank you. Sarah.
I booked my appointment to be diagnosed after hitting what felt like a rock bottom for me. My depression and anxiety got worse, which is often co-occurring with autism. And I was noticing that I was unable to communicate sometimes. I was exhausted constantly by light, sounds, and texture of clothes, and it just seemed to be getting worse and worse. And I couldn't keep up anymore in conversations. I wasn't understanding what people were saying, and I just felt overall like an alien. So I later found out that that chain of events is actually something called autistic burnout, and it often happens to people who are late diagnosed when they've been masking most of their life, and that masking creates physical, mental, and emotional toll on you. So that was what was the tipping point for me to find out.
Thank you. So the next question, some of you have touched on this a little bit in your comments that you've made so far, but we've had people ask, how did you feel about being diagnosed as autistic, and how do you think people are advantaged or disadvantaged through having a diagnosis? Kylie.
So for me, it was a bit of a relief. I was misdiagnosed, as a lot of females are, as bipolar, with early onset bipolar at the age of 4. So that was diagnosed when I was in my early 20s. And it was just a relief to actually have something, and then to be able to come off the amount of sedatives I was on. Like, when you're on 1,000 milligrams of sedative a day, something's got to give. And to be able to be free of that and to actually function makes a massive difference.
Great, thank you. Shadia?
I guess I'm coming from a different perspective, having been identified so young. So I guess from my perspective, having that early knowledge about my autism, particularly going through some of the rockier times for most people in life, like the adolescent years, it gave me a sense of empowerment of how my brain worked and why there are certain things I find really easy. Why I had a good attention to detail, for example, and why some of the other things were more challenging. So I have a tendency to mask, but having that self-awareness made me start to pick up on that and start to self-monitor. And it also gave me the opportunity to access the right supports, not only growing up, but going forward as an adult. So I guess having that knowledge was really power for me and for my family growing up and continuing on.
Thank you. It's interesting, a number of you commented on being diagnosed quite late, because one of the advanced questions we had was from someone who's currently going through the process themselves and asked whether those panelists who've been diagnosed later in life, did you feel that you had a bit of an identity crisis at first? And what advice do you have about unmasking and figuring out how to live more authentically? Sarah.
Yeah, 100%. And I still do, as this is really, really new to me. And it's really life-changing to learn that you're autistic in adulthood. It's a huge thing to go through. I think I'm privileged to have found out in my 20s, because a lot of people don't find out until they're much older, and it would be a lot harder. My own experience, however, has still involved a lot of grief and resentment over the loss of time, having not known myself and my own needs. And you have to allow yourself space to understand what's going on and reflect on the things that you know are true to you. So I've been journaling a lot about the things I have always been passionate about, just so I have a really strong sense of myself. And in regard to unmasking, I'm still working that one out. And I think a big part of that is just doing what you're comfortable with, because it's not as simple as jumping straight into stripping everything away that you've learned to do to cope with being different. And I focus on being comfortable stimming around others. Some people might not know what stimming is. That's just moving around and doing things that you feel that you need to do. And also recognizing when I'm overstimulated to prevent meltdowns as well.
Thank you. Jennifer.
Quite similar to Sarah. So in terms of an identity crisis, absolutely. I felt like it was sort of going back to the very start and, you know, replaying my life and being able to attribute things that I thought were, you know, failures or wrong or bad or weird or not normal about myself, and being able to rewrite that script and say, actually, this is because I was autistic and I am autistic and that's okay. It's given me a new language, and, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, we don't like, you know, clinical terms and that sort of thing. To an extent, I think that actually helped me to be able to label my behaviours and label, you know, processes that I go through without even knowing it. And then also in terms of unmasking, I think honesty is really important. And for me, you know, I really initially was all about meeting other people's expectations. You know, I have to do what's expected of me. I have to do what other people want me to do. And now I can say, actually, you know, I don't really enjoy being in a room full of 100 people. Not that we can do that now anyway with COVID, but, you know, all those sorts of things. And just being honest and saying, actually, I need more time. I need, you know, more notice if something's going to change. I need to be able to process things in a way that suits me. So, yeah, like Sarah, I don't have the answer. I wish I did, in terms of getting to that place where everything is, you know, this is me and it's accepted. So, yeah.
Thank you. How do you feel about disclosing your diagnosis, and how do you feel about people who prefer not to? Kylie.
So I've had experience of of telling people and not, and honestly, I get better outcomes in my life if I tell people. So stupid things that might sound stupid to some people, like the electricity is too loud. When I say something like that, those I work with and those who know me know that that is a trigger. There's something going on and I might not be able to express that. Whereas if someone didn't know that I was autistic and I said that, they might think I'm crazy. And as for people who choose not to, that is up to them. Everyone has that choice and we shouldn't take that away.
Thank you. Sarah.
Firstly, I agree with Kylie that it's really up to the person whether they are comfortable sharing that information or not with others. And I waited a few months before disclosing that I was autistic to the people who were not close to me. Most other people, like my family, I told straight away. And I have a brother who's autistic and has been his whole life. So that gave me confidence to disclose to my family in particular, although it was challenging as I'm very different to my brother, and my family have had 20 years of living with one stereotypical idea of autism. And after becoming interested in autism research and advocacy, I realized that there's a lot of significant challenges faced by the autistic community. And I felt that it was important to be open. And that was largely because I want to reduce stigma. So, and I'm lucky that I work at a university that's inclusive and accepting, but it was definitely not easy to share.
Thank you. Shadia?
I guess, well, I've known since I was about age 8, and I went to a primary school where there are a lot of other autistic students. So I guess for me, it's less difficult for me to actually explain to people what it means. So usually if I am telling a friend, for example, or sometimes I might have a moment of anxiety, I might just explain, look, I'm autistic. This means that I might take longer to process what I have to say, what you're saying and what we have to do. So this has been particularly helpful as a student when doing group work. And so sometimes when I'm comfortable with my peers, I will tell them and they go, oh, thank you, that's really helpful. There are certain times I won't tell people if I don't think it's necessary. So the person at the cafe who's serving me doesn't really need to know that I'm autistic. So I guess it's just choosing those moments. And I think that's a huge part of my own self-advocacy journey, has been identifying what I want to share with people and what might be helpful. But certainly in a uni context, having my lecturers and tutors know that I'm autistic has been incredibly helpful. And even just small things like them checking in with me, seeing if I'm okay, and being able to provide accommodations for me in the classroom, I think that's been really, really extremely helpful, and also sparked some open discussions about what autism means to me and in the wider scope, I guess, of the course. So, but I do understand that not all students feel safe doing that. Not all autistic people feel safe disclosing. And I respect that, you know, it's a journey for all of us, I think, that, you know, that road to self-advocacy. And I guess you just have to honour where that person is at the time and try and help them feel safe and feel proud, I guess, of being autistic. And that might come in many forms. It doesn't have to be disclosing it to every person. That might be just being able to explain to a friend when you have a meltdown, or explain to your family, you know, if you're having a challenge, you know, what that feels like for you.
Great, thank you. Now we have a question that's just popped up in the chat, which is actually a nice segue, I think, into our next segment. So the question from one of our attendees is, my daughter is on the spectrum and is currently 9 years old. Reflecting on it now, what did you consider the challenges you had when you were younger at primary and high school? Jennifer?
So the earliest memory that I have of being at school and being impacted by my literal brain was actually in kindergarten. So in 1993, the teacher wrote the date on the board. So, you know, the day, the month, and then the year, and 1993, and she said the first two numbers will change but the last number will never change. And I was like, okay, great, that doesn't change. So only when I get into the classroom the date and the month change. And then lo and behold, I was then in year one, and I sat in the classroom and the teacher put the date and it said 1994, and that was just, my mind was blown, my world fell apart. I didn't know that the year changed, nobody told me that, and so I couldn't work out why nobody else was bothered by it. So even just, you know, language, the language that's used in terms of instructions, in terms of learning about the world, how things work, you know, I knew that we went to a party every year at someone's house and everyone said Happy New Year, but I didn't draw the correlation between, you know, what was being written on the board every day. So I know that it's a small example, it's a silly example, but even just back to the basics of how things are explained, how messages are delivered, and then checking that the person understands them as well, regardless of their age.
Thanks. Shadia?
I guess for me, with primary school. My mum's actually in the audience today. So, but she had to provide a lot of, I guess, work alongside the teachers a lot in helping sort of understand why sometimes I wouldn't attend class or I would have a meltdown at school. So I guess my main impact has always been my sensory issues, because some of them are just unavoidable in the world and you can't always predict when a sensory issue might affect you, like a loud noise or, you know, even things like blight. I remember that in primary school, even small changes in routine and unpredictability would cause me just either to have a meltdown after I got home or just to not turn up to class. Even things that seem fun to other people, I found really upsetting because it was out of my routine. I didn't know what to expect. So things like when primary schools had movie days at the end of term or had activity week, I would actually have to take time off school because I couldn't cope with that change in routine. So I guess that's, again, been something that I have constantly had to work through. Even as an adult, there are some changes in routine that are still quite upsetting to me, and the cumulative effect of that as well can have a huge impact. And I think over COVID, we've all gone through the same thing. So I think it's a bit easier for me now to describe that to people. But I guess for me, using visual supports, like letting me know when we're going to move on to the next task. So timers are a big plus in our household, because transitioning between tasks has always been an issue with me. I often hyper-focus on one thing, but then being able to switch to another thing sometimes feels like a jolt if I don't get enough warning. So I guess keeping that in mind, that if a student acts in a way that might seem a bit strange, there might be an underlying trigger or cause for it. So, yeah, that's my perspective.
Thank you. So before we move on to the awareness section, I'll just check in with Bree that there aren't any other questions in the chat.
No, we're good, Sandra.
Okay. So the next question we have, which I thought was a really interesting one, when we were talking about awareness, what are you tired of explaining to people about your autism? Sarah?
I think this question is really funny because my answer to it is I'm tired of explaining why I'm autistic. And I think that largely comes because I'm like diagnosed of the people around me who've known me along we explain it when asked, especially when you're face to face with someone, because there's a lot to unpack. And right now, like my responses to this panel, I've had a lot of time to think about and write down. And I can't do that when I'm talking to someone face to face. And I often experience lapses in my vocabulary, and it's hard to put together neatly what I want to say. I have a lot of anxiety and I can't think clearly to convey all of that at once. And often because I mask so heavily and have been able to study and work, that makes it more surprising, and it shouldn't. And that's largely due to stereotypes and the lack of understanding of how diverse autism is. So I think it's really important to be educated on what autism can look like in lots of different environments. And that's why this panel is so important.
Great. Thank you. Kylie.
I am sick and tired of explaining to people that your autism just didn't appear. It's not because of vaccination. It's not because I wasn't disciplined or I wasn't spanked with a wooden spoon enough. And trust me, my mum may have broken 6 wooden spoons by the time I was 5. And it's those things that it's tiring. Why do I need to explain to someone where my autism came from? I was diagnosed for a reason. I was born like this. I don't need to justify that. But people seem to think that that is something I need to justify.
Yeah. Shadia.
Yeah, pretty much echoing what everyone else has said. I think, again, this sort of, I think there's still, whilst there's more awareness that there are autistic people in the community, I think there's still this very, this idea that it's a linear spectrum and that you are either low functioning or high functioning, there's nothing else in between. And I guess as someone who has been connected with the community. I have autistic friends, some are non-speaking, some have different ways of communicating, and all of us have different strengths and challenges. I guess from that point of view, my takeaway would be try not to judge us by our appearance and actually get to know us as individuals and see beyond just the linear model of the spectrum and see beyond just how much we appear to function to other people.
Great, thank you. Before I move on to the next question that I have here for you, there's a question in the chat, which is, I wonder what proportion of ACUs, of people at ACU are autistic? So I think I'll just bounce that one. So we do know that approximately 1 in 70 people are autistic. So I would love to say that it would be 1 in 70 people at ACU. I would suggest it's probably less than that because there are so many systemic barriers to autistic people being in education and in employment. And in fact, autistic people are less likely to be employed than people with other forms of disability consistently. So, you know, my answer to that question, what percentage of people at ACU are autistic, would be definitely not enough. And a lot more than we're aware of, a lot more than have disclosed, because there are so many barriers still to disclosure, and not a lot of benefits for a lot of people. So I would say a lot less than we're aware of, but also a lot less than there should be, and something we really need to be doing more and more about as universities and as employers to actually open up education and employment to autistic people. Because as you can see from our amazing panelists, we're pretty awesome people who have a lot to bring. So I figured I'd just take that one. Okay, so the next question we had on notice was, what do you say when someone says, you don't look autistic? Kylie.
I have two answers. The professional one is, what does autistic look like? And if you're pissing me off enough, you'll get, you don't look stupid, but here we are.
Thank you. Sarah.
I usually think, well, that's understandable because you can't see my brain. And it's my brain's modified wiring has led me to be autistic. And it's harmful to try and determine if another person is autistic based on what you can see. And it's the same as just as you wouldn't guess someone's gender just on what you can see. It's just not something you should do, and it's rude. So that's how I feel.
Okay, we have a question from a parent of an autistic child. Do you have any advice you wish that someone had given your parents when you were young? Kylie?
I don't have anything that I wish my parents knew because I'm in a different situation. My older sister has multiple disabilities. So my parents kind of went with the flow and understood what each of us kids needed. So for me, it was having parents that understood rather than, and you know, got the whole, sometimes this is too much, even without a diagnosis. So I think that's what the big advice I have is, just do what my parents did and go with that. Yeah, go with what I need.
Jennifer?
For me, not having had the diagnosis when I was young, one of the most important things I think is having the correct yardstick. So I would often get compared to other children, or, you know, this person doesn't have a problem with that, or, you know, why are you sensitive, or why are you this, or why are you that? So I think it comes back to expectations, and, you know, if there is an autism diagnosis, I think it's really important to not make comparisons and just have that person be that person and, you know, listened to in terms of what they struggle with, even though it might seem really simple for someone else, you know, it may not be for them. So just to take that, take it seriously, I guess.
Great, thank you. I love the next question. What has your autism enabled you to do that otherwise you may not have achieved? Kylie.
My autism's made me get where I am right now. My job with Bayside came through being autistic. We've built on that and I've got a new contract. But without that initial ability, and without that in, I would never have got where I am now. So I'm very grateful for that, and you know, it is my autism that got me there.
Great, thank you. Shadia?
I think my autism has really shaped my career pathway and wanting to help other people like me who experience other stigma or need some help with their communication or accessing certain environments. So I do believe that my autism has been an asset in providing that different perspective, and I guess having an empathy for autistic individuals and families. I guess the fact that I resonate with animals deeply, I don't think I do attribute to my autism, and has also shaped the way that I viewed supports for autistic people. And my attention to detail has also given me a great analytic mind and the ability to pick up on other things that other people miss. So I see them as great strengths.
Thank you. We've had someone ask, what considerations could I keep in mind to build and maintain positive relationships with an autistic person? So they've specifically asked about things like body language, communication, cues, language. So what are the sorts of things that people should be keeping in mind to make sure they're maintaining positive relationships? Kylie?
We're individuals, so find out what it is that we need. About 12 months ago, one of my colleagues said, get to know the person like you'd get to know anyone else and find out what it is that they need, what it is that annoys them, what, you know, those things that you would do with anyone else who didn't have a diagnosis, that you know, didn't have that stigma attached. So get to know the person and ask them.
Thank you. Sarah?
I think it's really important to understand the differences in communication and not assume that we understand the intricacies that are not immediately obvious. It often means being a lot more open about what you mean with what you say. It's helpful to be direct and ensure that the autistic person understands your tone. And I have a lot of trouble with sarcasm in particular. And I personally love it if someone is reassuring with me and patient enough to let me ask questions or reiterate what they said just to make sure that I'm not misinterpreting anything. And it can also be helpful to ask what the preferred method of communication is, because an email might be better than talking over the phone, for example. It helps eliminate a lot of anxiety about communicating, and you can be a lot more direct with that as well.
Thank you. Shadia?
I guess learning a bit more about how autistic communication styles can present. There's been a lot of really interesting research on the theory of double empathy, which looks at the fact that autistic communication is different from non-autistic communication, but it's not necessarily a deficit. So I guess the way that I would apply that in daily life is just, as everyone else has said, getting to know the individual. I guess from my perspective, I do tend to relate to other people through my interests, and I tend to avoid the small talk, which might appear rude to other people, but it's just the way I operate. I do struggle with sometimes reading nonverbal cues. So I used to get really confused when someone's tone of voice wouldn't match what their body language was saying, and sometimes I would have difficulty interpreting that. So I guess checking in that we're understanding, and as I think Sarah said, our preferred methods of communication can be really helpful, even for us autistics who can speak. Sometimes it's easier to use written forms over that face-to-face communication.
Thank you. I'd really like to encourage people, we're doing quite well for time, so we do have a little bit of time left. So please do put any questions you have in the chat. I know we've sort of focused a lot on the questions that came to us in advance, but I know that people will have come with questions. So please do stick any questions in the chat that you would like to ask. Bree has her hand up, so I assume that means there's a question.
Sandra, there's questions coming in thick and fast, I will say. I don't know if we'll have time to get to them all. I'll just maybe read out some. There's one here. I work on the diversity and inclusion committee at ACU. What things can be done to make workplace more inclusive for autistic people? Thank you. Yep. There's a heap, so we might not get to all of them. So I know I've expressed that the panel will perhaps submit some in writing post this session today.
So I might just also remind people that obviously if you've got pressing questions, we will answer them, but we're trying to keep this session as much as possible to sort of general questions around autism and understanding autism. We are going to have a session on workplaces, we are going to have a session on university education, and we are going to have a session on primary and secondary. So I'm not ignoring that question, Bree, and I will come back to it. I just want to check that we don't have any other questions in the chat at the moment that are on that broader awareness topic. Bree?
Sorry. Someone said about diagnosis, about many of the challenges stated today are characteristic to autism are similar to ADD and ADHD. Is there any way to delineate the difference, and have any of you been misdiagnosed? Kylie has already mentioned that she was misdiagnosed with bipolar as a young person. Has anyone else received a misdiagnosis?
Sarah.
This is very relevant to me because I have noticed since being diagnosed with autism that there's a lot of extra things that I have going on that are not necessarily autism and I've realized might be ADHD. So that's been a really big thing for me, is trying to tease out all the things that are going on and whether there's overlap of ADHD and autism, which seems to be quite a really big thing for autistic people. It's becoming a hot topic in research space, the overlap between the two. So for me, that's been really hard. And I know that there's not a lot of expertise in that space either. Not a lot of understanding on what that looks like, having more than one diagnosis. That's something that the research will probably focus on a lot more in future, especially around the misdiagnosis.
Thank you. Kylie?
So I have the dual diagnosis of autism ADHD, and so it can become complex because I will hyperfocus, but then I can easily become distracted. So it sounds like they're completely different, but they do work together and create strengths, create weaknesses. And I think the last time I looked into it, I think it was 17 or 18% of people with autism also have ADHD. So it's actually not that uncommon. And yesterday, someone, and I don't remember which Facebook page I saw it on, actually released a heap of what are the traits across the two conditions, plus, yes, Shadia saw it too, so it must be the page we're both on, plus the different characteristics of autism and ADHD. And, yeah, the overlap is massive, but you see it in both ways with, yeah, if I don't take my ADHD meds, you're not going to get me to function at any sort of level. So, yeah, it is what it is, but it does happen. And it's not often misdiagnosed. It's usually right.
Thank you. Bree, did you have more questions for us?
I'm just trying to triage them, Sandra. There's a lot coming through. So I don't, in terms of diagnosis, not really. So, sorry, guys, I'll get to you. I'm just, trying to triage them according to topic. you guys carry on and I'll get to you, Sandra.
Okay. So I will just, again, we will be having multiple sessions. So please don't feel that if your question doesn't get answered, it's not going to get answered. We will have a get together after this and put them in groups and then set up subsequent sessions to look at specific topics. One of the questions that's been asked by one of the pre-attendees was around being able to identify someone who is autistic as opposed to thinking someone is misbehaving. Particularly this question has been asked in the context of children and, you know, that the way that people respond in public to behaviour that doesn't align with social norms. And how do we help parents when in public? Or do we not help? Should we stay out of their way, or are there things we could do to support parents? Shadia?
I guess I can speak to my mum's experience when I would have public meltdowns was there were a mixture of responses. Some were good, some were bad. I guess it doesn't just apply to autistic children, it applies to any child, that if you just look at the behavior, you're not getting the full context. So sometimes, I'm sure this is probably a familiar story to some people, particularly parents, but when I would have a meltdown at the shop, some people would make comments like, you're not disciplining your child enough, and you know, your child should be behaving like that in public. And then usually the parents that did stop and help were usually either parents of autistic children themselves or had some connection to a family member. And what they did would say things, can I help? Can I grab your shopping? And whilst mum would comfort me and basically help me de-escalate. So I guess if you see a parent who's struggling in public, being able to just ask, is everything okay? Do you need me to grab something for you? Or at least just offer a helping hand, I think is much better than casting judgment on the parenting style or the behavior of the child, because it's pretty much been debunked in research that autism is not caused by bad parenting. So I guess being able to assist, sometimes parents might say, no, there's nothing you can do, but at least you've been able to offer that support. So that's my perspective. My mum might say something in the chat differently, but that's our perspective, yeah. And I guess as an adult, actually, I had a meltdown in the train a couple of years ago, which it wasn't a sort of fight meltdown. Some of the other panelists might relate to this, where it was more of a shutdown, went mute, couldn't speak. And the only person who helped me on the train was another autistic person who happened to be sitting opposite me. And I guess I got a bit of a perspective of seeing people staring at me, seeing people visibly alarmed. I felt quite isolated in the moment and I felt quite scared because I couldn't verbalize what I was going through. I couldn't explain to people what I was going through, and having someone break through that and ask, can I help you, meant a lot to me. And I've got so many of my speechy friends from my course who've now set up AAC cards and things for me to take on the train in case that happens. So I guess being an ally is just being there.
Great. Thanks, Shadia. I think you made a really important point there, that people ask those questions of us in the context of children, but they are also very, very valid for adults. And I know that all of us as autistic people will resonate with that, having been in situations where our behaviour has seemed very, very strange to people. And it is actually quite scary. So I'm glad that you raised that isn't just an issue for children. Bree?
Just had a question about in a moment of meltdown, what can others do to help you?
Kylie?
It's going to depend on the person. So for me, the best thing anyone can do is leave me alone. Don't talk to me. You'll get screamed at. Understand that if I need help, I will go to you. And I've usually reached out if I know I'm heading to meltdown. So last week, I knew I was getting to that point. I could hear the electricity. So I went to the person I directly report to. I can hear the electricity. And after she stopped laughing, and I absolutely love Sal and I know she's in here, and we were both hysterical, and we still are today, we spoke about it. That was enough for me to prevent that meltdown, because she got it that I'm not being stupid, I'm not being crazy. I genuinely have an issue. And right now I need to walk away from my computer. I need to shut down. And it's that understanding. And I guess for me is even more is I'm pretty much in an office by myself at the moment. And I did have a decent sized meltdown last year. And what that meant was I then had to go to a different department and go, hey, yesterday I had a meltdown. Next time it happens, if you ever notice it, this is what you do. Because they needed to know, and the people in the building needed to know. So for me, yeah, if you see me on the floor crying, probably leave me alone. And we also have another procedure, which is if the fire alarm goes off and we have to evacuate, make sure you direct me to the toilet, because I'm going to end up out on one of the main roads in Sandringham, probably getting hit by a car, and that's not a safe thing. So we have those procedures in place. Another thing is I don't tend to go anywhere without someone who knows me. So they know what they're going to do if I have a meltdown, such as being at a pub a couple of weeks ago, something set me off, and another person who is in this first thing she said is, okay, let's get you an Uber and get you home. So it's having those people who know and can see those triggers around you. And the reality is most of us aren't going somewhere without someone who knows what to do in those circumstances.
Thank you. Sarah.
I have sort of a different perspective because I more often experience shutdowns more than meltdowns. So for instance, if I go to the shops and I'm already quite overstimulated from my day and I'm doing it at the end of the day and it's at a time when there's lots of people around, the clinical lighting in the shops, lots of colors, noises going on, I often start to feel like I can't talk and I go really quiet and the people with me, they notice there's a very instant change and I look like I'm zoning out and I feel like I'm experiencing this real out of body sensation and everything starts to become brighter and louder. And I often just need space and to be away from those things that are causing the problem. And it's hard when you're trying to do things that you need to do, like being at work. Sometimes I experience this and you have to deal with people coming in and out of the office and walking around the corridor. So I normally just isolate myself, shut my door, go to the bathroom to have 5 minutes away from people in a quiet space. Having people know that I'm autistic and understanding that I might need that, that's really helpful to me.
Thank you. Shadia.
I guess touching on the points that were already raised, knowing what my triggers are for meltdowns has been really important, not only for myself, but for the people around me, my educators, and of course my family, and having those regular check-ins, particularly around times, let's say there's exam time and you know it's likely to be stressful for students, maybe just keeping an eye on the neurodivergent students and making sure they're tracking along okay. I really resonate with what Sarah said about shutdown over meltdowns. I find that even when I was younger at primary school, my more, I guess, obviously autistic outbursts would happen at home. I would tend to be the model student at school and then come home and one day apparently I just screamed straight in the car. So I guess for me, being able to identify the supports can help me in that moment has been really powerful. So I've got another now who would start to accompany me into university to help things that take away spoons. So you might have heard of spoon theory, that's used as a bit of an analogy for energy. So for me, having her alert me to when I'm starting to become overwhelmed has been really powerful. Even things like I might start to stim more and she'll nudge my hand, or when I start to zone out, she'll alert me and I'll think, oh, okay, there's something that's overwhelming me. I need to take a break, or things like that. And I guess if you notice an autistic person in a meltdown, if you know the person and their triggers, trying to take them away, not take them away, but remove the triggers that might be exacerbating it. And I guess for me, being able to have a quiet room just to zone out and just drown out whatever stimuli overwhelming me is really important. But I would say that it's before the meltdown happens that's more helpful than in the meltdown, because sometimes you just have to let it run its course and make sure we're still safe, obviously, while it's happening. But it's before that's the key, really.
Great, thank you. Now, in a minute, Bree, I'm going to pass to you and I'm going to put pressure on you because you can give us one more question before the end. But before we do that, I just wanted to remind people that all of your questions that have been put in the chat, we will be looking at. We'll be grouping them and putting them into future sessions. And also, if there's specific questions that are pressing, we will respond to you directly or in the chat under this meeting. Also, our panelists have all offered that they're available. If people have specific questions in relation to their own experience or the experience of a family member or student, and there's a particular panel member that you would like to reach out to, you can email Bree and she will pass on contact details for you. So we really do see this as a continuing conversation. We want to have a number of these sessions and we want to do everything we can to support you in being autistic and supporting autistic people. So Over to you, Bree, for one last burning question.
Oh, the pressure. So I guess do you have any tips or advice for younger autistic people for social settings and how to manage the lovely joys that are high school?
Kylie.
High school sucks regardless if you're autistic or not. But I guess for me, be you. Don't try and fit in, because fitting in is not getting you anywhere. I speak to one person, 20 years later from high school. I have a couple of others who are on my Facebook and occasionally chat with. But the reality is none of them got me, and that's fine. I'm me. I'm not, the popular kid. I'm not the, I was a smart kid. Guess what? It's not going to change. Those people are not your friends. They are nasty. They're always going to be like that regardless if, So, high school sucks. It's not going to make any difference. Just be you.
Great. Thank you. Shadia.
As someone who went to high school, I think a few years ago, time goes quickly. I guess for me, being able to unmask and realise that there are some environments that, I've identified there's some I do want to access. There are some that I'm simply not interested in. I'm not ever going to enjoy neurotypical parties and gatherings. I'm not going to be enjoying things that aren't interest-based. And I guess being able to identify what settings I want to access and what types of people I want to hang out with has been really empowering. There are some autistic people who don't have any social motivation and they're more than happy with that. I've got plenty of friends who I speak to maybe once or twice a year, and they're fine with that, and that works for them. There are other friends who are really social who do want to access those spaces. So I guess for me, the supports that have really helped me is that when I've wanted further accommodations or support, where to find them. And I think it's really great that there are a lot more autistic-led social opportunities and activity-based social opportunities that are being made available. And I guess, just be yourself, because you're not going to find people who get you or resonate with you by masking. And that's been a key takeaway for me in, ongoing, not just through high school, but
Thank you. Jennifer.
If I could go back and talk to my high school self, I would say that, if there aren't people at in your grade or in your high school that you resonate with, there is no reason that you can't have friends that don't go to your school. And as Shadia said, have them be, interest-based friendships. So whatever it is that, someone is interested in, if they follow that passion, then there's going to be a point in time that they find someone else who's also passionate about the things that they are. So I think that, with high school, just remembering that it could be divided into high school is the place you go to learn, and then there are other friendship opportunities either after school or on the weekend. So just a different perspective.
Thank you. And Sarah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Jennifer. I wish that I didn't get so caught up in the social side of school, because it ended up making my time at school really harsh on me. And definitely something that you just need to be yourself and accept that you can't be friends with everybody. Not everyone's going to like you. And a saving grace for me was having the art room and the home ec room to go to at lunchtimes, because when you are experiencing those times when you don't have friends and people are considering you as an outsider, having somewhere to go so that you don't have to sit by yourself, that was really important to me. So that would be my advice, trying to find ways to accommodate those things that make you uncomfortable at school, help you get through it a lot easier.
Great, thank you. I think we've gone perfectly to time. It's 1:59. So thank you everyone for coming. I'm going to ask people if they don't mind to turn their cameras on for a second, because I'm going to ask you to thank our amazing panelists. And for those of you who are not autistic, I'm going to introduce you to our preferred way of clapping. So when I ask you to thank our wonderful panel members, we're all big fans of quiet clapping, which is a lot less sensory input. So a huge thank you to our panelists for their time, their honesty, their commitment, You guys are amazing, and we really, really appreciate you being able to, you know, come and really share your stories. And we look forward to seeing lots of you at future sessions, and our panelists will be back to answer all the rest of your questions. So thank you very much.